Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features media's challenges and responsibilities. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Weezy Montali. The music in the background is Eye of the Hurricane by Herbie Hancock Trio, featuring Herbie Hancock, Ron Carter, and Billy Cobham, commemorating Ron Carter's birthday, which is May 4th. Since 1994, May 3rd has been commemorated yearly as World Press Freedom Day, following the proclamation by the United Nations General Assembly in December 1993 that every May 3rd would be World Press Freedom Day. May 3rd is the anniversary of the Windhoek Declaration of May 3rd, 1991, and that's in Windhoek, Namibia, where African journalists put together principles for an independent, pluralistic press, reaffirming that freedom of information is a fundamental human right. This year, the theme is A Press for the Planet, Journalism in the Face of the Environmental Crisis. Today, the show features recent conversation with journalists about issues concerning the media, the challenges such as financial constraints, attacks and killings of journalists, political interference, and more, the responsibilities such as disseminating accurate information, professionalism, and more. Joining the show from Lilongwe is Jisoma Ngluwe. She's the vice chairperson of Media Institute of Southern Africa, Malawi, that's MISA Malawi. Jisoma Ngluwe has over 20 years experience in various media capacities and is a 2017 Harvard University Nieman Journalism Fellow. Currently, she is head of broadcasting at the Malawi Parliament. Also featured from Washington, D.C. is Abdulrahim Fukara, and he is the Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera, who has over 30 years experience in journalism in various positions at the BBC and Al Jazeera. First, you'll hear a portion of my conversation with Abdulrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera. That features comments from South African journalist Mbisa Bakude of the Mail and Guardian on SABC TV program Media and Society, entitled High Journalist Deaths in Gaza War, and that was on January 14, 2024. Here is the conversation with Abdulrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera. Abdulrahim Fukara, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Muiza. Good talk to you.
Yes, great to have you after a long time. It's been a while, a number of years, having you back on the show.
I know. It's been many, many, many years. And through all those many years, the world has gone through several major convulsions, obviously, including the current one.
Yes. And as speaking of the current situation, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 99 journalists were killed worldwide in 2023. And they say, quote, more than three quarters of the 99 journalists and media workers killed worldwide in 2023 died in the Israel-Gaza war. The majority of them Palestinian killed in Israeli attacks on Gaza. The conflict claimed the lives of more journalists in 3 months than have ever been killed in a single country over an entire year. That's the quote from the article, which is entitled Israel-Gaza War Brings 2023 Journalist Killings to a Devastating High by Kathy Jones in the Committee to Protect Journalists, February 15, 2023. And you also talked about this in the Al Jazeera Online article of May 3rd to commemorate World Press Freedom Day. You noted that more than 100 journalists and media workers, the vast majority Palestinian, have been killed in the first 7 months of the war in Gaza. And you're citing, according to Committee to Protect Journalists and the International Federation of Journalists. not to say that you wrote this, but this was the Al Jazeera Online. So sorry to say that. Yeah. And before we start, I also wanted to put in context what these two pieces of material I've just read are saying from a segment from South African Broadcasting Corporation TV show entitled Media and Society, which was looking at the high journalist deaths in Gaza war. This was on January 14th, 2024. And the person you're going to hear is Tembisa Fakunde. And he's of the Mail and Guardian in South Africa. And he's talking about how this situation has created the different perceptions by Northern Hemisphere press people and Southern press people. Let me play it and then we can discuss further.
Mr. Fakunde, I want to bring you in here. Juanita, as we started the discussion, talked about the importance of journalists around the world, but particularly here in South Africa, let's look at what we can do, needing to be more vocal about what we're seeing happening to journalists in Gaza, and certainly speaking out against the war in Gaza, which we've seen South Africa do in its approach of the International Court of Justice. What is it that journalists can and should be doing, and are we burying our heads in the sand as South African storytellers?
Yes, I think we are, but first of all, let me just say that, you know, I worked with Wail Dahlud in Gaza, spent a substantial number of time in, a substantial time in that office in Gaza with Wail. So I know Hamza when he was a little baby. In fact, when he was born, I knew him, the journalist that was killed last week. So, you know, for me to answer your question directly is that seeing what happened to Wail and his family, and to have this silence and unwillingness and dragging of feet in terms of condemnation of what's happening in Israel by our own colleagues, by the way. And unfortunately, it's an institution such as Al Jazeera, which has suffered a lot in this conflict. But we have this reluctance from our own colleagues, not only in South Africa, but around the world, where, you know, some of us have made it our mission to amplify these atrocities whenever they happen, wherever they happen, whoever. The impact, but unfortunately this time around we don't see that enthusiasm. In fact, when this ICJ sitting took place both on the 11th and the 12th of this month, some of the international media organizations decided on a blackout not to show the happenings in that proceeding. That tells you that is a challenge. And unfortunately, you know, we find ourselves at the moment with a very weakened solidarity amongst journalism. I think when the dust settles, which is the new word that everybody uses in Gaza, you are like going to see us and them for correct reasons. So you're not going to see the type of solidarity that we've had in the past, because many of our colleagues have decided to hide their heads under the sand. And it will be very difficult for the journalists, particularly those of the global south, now to be enthusiastic in terms of their own solidarity and support of journalists from the global north. I think that's out the window henceforth. You're not going to see that happening anymore. I mean, if you have this quiet and silence, notwithstanding that there's been so many atrocities and harm, death on our own colleagues in Gaza, it's going to be very difficult to expect that the Gazans and other journalists from the global south are now continuing to be, you know, enthusiastic in terms of speaking in favor or on behalf of other journalists in the global south. So it's an indictment. And I think we have to go back and rewrite the history books, including the principles of journalism, because everything is questioned. You know, we've got this moral equivalency in terms of reporting, which is questioned. Our colleagues from the global north have violated every one of those principles in terms of the moral equivalency. The truth versus objectivity gone out the window.
Yeah.
So we're talking about new journalism here, and we have to be honest. That is no longer going to be the same. You don't expect that the journalists from the global south henceforth are going to be calling solidarity and global solidarity with journalists around the world. It's not going to happen. And we've seen this hypocrisy, irritating, disappointing from some people that you thought would stand firm in terms of journalism rights. They've said no it. Institutions that we went out, some of us, in support of when their journalists were in trouble, nothing have been said. What we have at the moment is activism mainly emanating from Qatar and Doha, where many of the journalists are impacted. But other than that, you see nothing else happening. And yeah. This is a very, very sad day in history and in the journalism profession.
After hearing that comment by the South African journalist Thembisa Fukunda, he's of the Mail and Guardian. What would your comments under that analysis be? And this, of course, this was in January this year, January 14th, to be precise. How spot on is he on that analysis?
Well, I mean, I hope that his predictions are wrong and that after the war on Gaza is over, the interest and solidarity between journalists in the global north and global south will continue. But that's my hope. Beyond the hope, I think that he is raising a very critical issue. And I think he knows what he's talking about. And this is something that has been of interest to me personally for a long time. You know, the interest of the media when it comes to press freedom and when it comes to journalists who are harassed or imprisoned or killed, I'm afraid, you know, this interest has been siloed. The journalists in one part of the world tend to be concerned with journalists in their part of the world, in their neck of the woods. They tend to be the purview tends to be very ethnocentric. If you are in the US, you are basically interested in the fate of what happens to journalists in the US. I'm broadening the net here, obviously, but that's generally the case. If you are in the Middle East, you are interested in what happens to journalists in the Middle East. If you are in Africa, the same thing applies more or less. The same thing applies in Latin America and so on and so forth. And, you know, we journalists globally, we continue to express fear and concern that unless we do something about, you know, the trials and tribulations of journalists, of fellow journalists, you know, things will not improve. And yet, when the chips are down, each region is generally focused on the plight of its own journalists. So the journalist, the colleague from South Africa in that clip, I think he was right on in terms of expressing his concern. I mean, just recently, for the last several days, World Press Freedom Day, I attended events at the National Press Club here in Washington, D.C., and this issue was raised. I mean, when you talk to journalists from the global north, west, from the west, and you say, you know, everyone should be focused on the fate of Ivan Gershkovich, the U.S. journalist held in Moscow. Everyone should be concerned about the fate of Austin Tice, the U.S. journalist who disappeared in Syria, including in the Middle East. But also in the U.S., everyone should be concerned about the killing of the Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Akleh. Everyone in the West should be concerned about, you know, the killing of, you know, a shocking number of journalists in Gaza. And yet that's not the case, unfortunately. And I don't know what it needs to take for journalists to band together in a sustained, not sporadic way, in a sustained way to defend the rights and the safety of fellow journalists, whether they are in America, the Middle East, in Africa, Latin America, Asia, wherever. I don't know what it will eventually take to get that sort of, you know, close solidarity, which is, you know, which has a practical value, which is to defend the rights and safety of everyone globally, rather than, you know, this particular region concerned with its journalists and their fate, and that particular region is concerned with the fate and safety of its own journalists.
Yeah, I'd like to unpack that a little further. Do you think that the one of the issues that's affecting that solidarity is the way, as you see it, is particularly when I see in the global north, particularly how journalism has blurred the lines of becoming part of the power elite? Do you see that that's also had some effect on how this there's been the siloing, as you said, the siloing of people just focusing on their certain regions? You think also that's worldwide there's been this a problem of the journalists becoming part of the elite class?
Well, I mean, there are several things to say here, importantly. One of them, obviously, you know, like I live in the West. I've lived in the West for more than two decades now. And there are wonderful things to be said about, you know, press freedom in the West and the interest in press freedom and so on. But it also has to be said that there has been until relatively recently, a lot of arrogance in the West, because these journalists who get harassed, who get targeted, who get imprisoned, who get killed, you know, only existed in the global South. That's the perception that was prevalent in the West. And then more recently, we started seeing nasty things happening to Western journalists as well. You know, I mentioned Ivan Gerskovich, the American journalist currently held in Moscow, Austin Tice, who disappeared in Syria. We've been hearing descriptions by Western politicians of the media as being the enemy of the people. So, you know, suddenly, when I say suddenly, I'm talking in relative terms, the West, Western journalists also have been discovering that, you know, this is not just about the global South. This is a disease that, you know, infects the journalistic body, whether you're talking about the South or the North. You know, the issue of press freedom, for all the talk about press freedom in the West, and it is a wonderful value, obviously, you know, we have seen journalists in the West go through a lot of problems, a lot of turmoil when it comes to their own safety and to their right to report freely. So suddenly this arrogance began to occupy a central position, but it hasn't got Western journalists to a point where they would change their purview so that the plight of journalists in general become of interest to them. But it also has to be said, you know, it's a two-way street. You know, I cover the plight of Middle Eastern journalists all the time, including the killing of my colleague Shirin Abu Akhla, what happened to the Al Jazeera correspondent, my colleague Wa'il Dahdouh in Gaza. Several members of his family were killed, including his son, by the Israelis recently in the war. And it's very, very difficult to find the space while you're talking about these things in the Arab world, in the Middle East, to talk about Austin Tice or Ivan Gerskovich and so on. So obviously the dynamics have to be changed so that the journalists in the global North and in the global South have to find some common ground whereby the issues of one part of the world also become the issues vitally of the other part of the world. Otherwise, you know, this siloed purview that's now prevalent in the world is really a very, very dangerous equation, which doesn't, you know, do much to bolster the safety of journalists either in the South or in the North.
And I guess when we also talk about the North, we have to also keep in mind that progressive journalism has always been under attack, and as well as, you know, journalists who covered things like the Vietnam War or the civil rights movement. They were not seen popular at the beginning. It's just later on when history writes itself, they tend to be seen as the people who have been writing on them have been were always supported, but it's not always the case. I guess it's always making sure we properly write that history, that people who covered Watergate at the beginning were really not necessarily a cause célèbre at the very beginning. They were actually doing a lot of hard work and they also had the challenges which they faced in other places, and it could have gone either way in some cases. So I guess that's one thing that probably we always have to keep making sure.
You mentioned two critical things. It's a good thing that you mentioned Watergate and how the events like the Vietnam War were covered in the US. So obviously, you know, for the Watergate scandal was a watershed, because here you have a major mainstream US newspaper, the Washington Post, covering a critical issue to the U.S. and to the rest of the world in the form of the Watergate scandal. And when you compare the behavior or the coverage of mainstream media back then in the 60s, 70s, and part of the 80s, with their coverage of various events today, I mean, the difference or the disparity in purview it can be really shocking. I mean, to think that currently in the United States, thousands of students are protesting on campuses across the land. They're protesting the Israeli war on Gaza, and the coverage that, you know, this critical event is receiving from traditional media in traditional mainstream media in the US is really minimal compared with the coverage of social media, the coverage that students themselves are providing for this event, whether they are for Palestine or for Israel. So obviously we are in a different world today when it comes to the relationship, as you called it, Muiza, earlier, the relationship between the media and power, because the powers that be and the many of the mainstream media, whether you're talking about the US or the Middle East or Latin America or Africa, there's an echo chamber. More so than in the past. It's the alternative media now that, you know, people are resorting to for finding out really what's going on in these various events. And in the same way that various governments around the world have harassed traditional media correspondents and journalists in the past, and they continue to do so, they are also taking sometimes radical measures to make sure that social media are brought to heel. This is the case whether you're talking about, you know, Africa, whether you're talking about the Middle East, whether you're talking about Latin America, Asia, in some cases even here in the US. So the dynamics are taking us in a different direction, and at the same time, there's more of the same. This does not change what we discussed earlier. The fact that journalists' purviews continue to be siloed, unless there's a global position by the media and journalists to defend their right to report and to defend their safety. And being able to report, you know, we're just going to be having this conversation over and over and over again.
Again, that's Abdulrahim Fukara. He is the Washington bureau chief of Al Jazeera. And we're looking at the media's challenges, freedom, and responsibility in connection with World Press Freedom Day, which was just recently on May the 3rd. In the backdrop of World Press Freedom Day, you've had Al Jazeera banned in Israel. If you could expand on this, where the ban is taking place, what are the geographical areas in Israel and Palestine where it's been banned, Al Jazeera's been banned, and why all of a sudden now?
So, you know, the government of Israel has had a beef with Al Jazeera for a long, long time, long before the war on Gaza, as have had other governments in the region and elsewhere in the world, including the government of the United States on and off. But, you know, for the Israelis to make the critical decision of banning Al Jazeera at this particular point in the war, the Israeli war on Gaza, is obviously a unique event. It's a unique event because Al Jazeera has been the main source of information and of documentation, if you will, of the war on Gaza, you know, over the last 7-8 months, basically since the events of October the 7th. And, you know, banning Al Jazeera in Israel is obviously a big problem for Al Jazeera. No news network wants to be banned from, you know, an important part of the world during a critical event. But it's also a very short-sighted decision by the Israeli government, because in the world of 2024, you know, other than shooting yourself in the foot and making it, you know, a big PR issue for yourself, banning an international news network. News networks in today's world, they'll find a way to cover what they want to cover, whether you allow them to do it or not. You know, it's a bad day for Al Jazeera that the Israeli government has made that decision, but it's not going to cripple Al Jazeera's coverage or put an end to it. Al Jazeera has gone through similar situations many times over in the past, and it always finds a way to continue to cover whatever issue it's focused on. What we know so far is that the ban does apply to Al Jazeera in Israel, Al Jazeera's offices in Israel were in occupied East Jerusalem, where Al Jazeera has its offices. These offices were raided by the Israeli security services. It's going to apply, the ban is going to apply in the Golan Heights, for example, which Donald Trump had recognized as being part of Israeli sovereignty. It's from everything that we've heard, it's not going to apply to Gaza or the West Bank.
That was a portion of my recent conversation with Abdulrahim Fukara, who is the Washington bureau chief of Al Jazeera, and I was looking at the challenges and constraints of the media, and we also highlighted specific issues concerning Al Jazeera, such as the situation of Al Jazeera journalists being killed in Gaza. Next, you're going to hear a portion of my recent conversation with another media expert, a journalist from Lilongwe, and that is Jisomo Ngluwe, who is the Vice Chairperson of Media Institute of Southern Africa, MISA, Malawi. And the conversations I had with these journalists was about issues concerning the media, the challenges such as financial constraints, attacks and killings of journalists, political interference, and more. and their responsibilities such as disseminating accurate information, professionalism, and more. And we present these two conversations as we commemorate World Press Freedom Day, which was on May 3rd. And the full conversations will be available on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is All the Way from Africa by Keturah. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW, 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the show with the conversation with the journalist from Lilongwe, Chisoma Ngulue, who is the vice chairperson of Media Institute of Southern Africa, Malawi. That's MISA Malawi. Chisoma Ngulue, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mwiza.
Thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us. I know this has been a very busy weekend because of the annual World Press Freedom Day. And before we get deep into the conversation, if you could describe the general workings of the Media Institute of Southern Africa and the specific workings of the Media Institute of Southern Africa, MISA Malawi chapter, so that people have an idea of what you do.
So once again, thank you very much, Misa, for having me in the program. Indeed, we are MISA Malawi, and basically we are one of the 11 chapters of the Media Institute of Southern Africa. And so MISA has country chapters, and Malawi is one of those chapters. In terms of the work that we do, our main interest and focus is to promote and defend media freedom. We are interested in freedom of expression. Pursuant to the Windhoek Declaration 1991, which I'm sure you're aware of, and so we are membership driven. We have not less than 500 members, journalists, and other media practitioners here in Malawi.
Yeah, I guess if you could kind of brief us on the Windhoek Declaration of May, that was in May 1991, right? May 3rd and 3rd, and how that's important in terms of the World Press Freedom Day, because most people in the audience, I don't think, know of the Windhoek Declaration. So if you could just highlight that, because that's so important, this, the fact in terms of this this day and also about media freedom, that Africa played a critical role in that.
Indeed, Africa did play quite a very critical role in coming up with the World Press Freedom Day, May 3rd, because from April 29th to May 3rd in 1991, people met in Windhoek in Namibia, which is in southern Africa, to discuss issues of press freedom. You will recall that at the time, most African countries were under dictatorial regimes. And so press freedom was more of a dream than a reality. In most African countries, including Malawi, the press, journalists were not free to write. People also were not free to express themselves. So the Windhoek Declaration heralded a new era that promised an independent press, but also pluralistic press, because more often what we saw back then was that power was concentrated, of course, in dictators. And that was also the case with the media, that there were these state-run media companies, broadcasters, newspapers. In most instances, you have probably one newspaper in a country. And so the Windhoek Declaration championed pluralistic media. But you can't have that without democracy. So pluralistic media and democracy, they go hand in hand, because in essence, we are promoting a multiplicity of voices, a multiplicity of opinions, in the media. So those were some of the highlights of the Windhoek Declaration that gave birth to the freedom of the press, World Press Freedom Day that we commemorate today.
And that was begun in 1993, as I think we recall, right? The first one. That,
the declaration was signed in 1991.
Yeah, and then but then the commemoration started in 1993.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, yeah. And in terms of MISA Malawi, that's the Media Institute of Southern Africa, Malawi, are most of the Malawian media workers, whether it's reporters, writers, online writers, camera people, etc., TV media folks, are members of MISA Malawi?
Yes, most of them are, but we also have the Media Council of Malawi, which in essence is supposed to have the regulatory role. Our main role has been to fight for and defend and promote media freedom, freedom of expression, and access to information here in Malawi.
So do you have a percentage of the media people in Malawi who are MISA members, MISA Malawi members?
I would say that it's the majority. I would not, you would not be able to produce percentages because we are increasingly getting people joining the profession. But I would say the majority, because we, at the moment, it's about, I mentioned about 500, over 500, close to 600, and sometimes it gets up to 800 people that affiliate with us.
And again, that's Chisoka Mongluwe. She is the vice chairperson of Media Institute of Southern Africa, MISA, Malawi. And she has over 20 years experience in various media capacities. Currently, she's head of broadcasting at the Malawi Parliament and is a 2017 Harvard University Nieman Journalism Fellow. We're looking at media's challenges, freedom, and responsibility. And in the context of the World Press Freedom Day, which is on May 3rd, and this year, again, is also a special year regionally for Southern Africa. It's 30 years since the first free, non-racial elections in South Africa, which was on April 1994. And also 30 years of multi-party elections after 30 years of one-party rule in Malawi, and also 30 years since the first elections in Mozambique after a long conflict. What are some of the regional broad lessons in light of all these various important historical events which affect the regions that the media has learned from each other, looking at these different contexts?
I think that it is indeed an election year in most Southern African countries. We could have also been having an election here in Malawi had it not been for the fact that we held fresh elections. So the 90s really heralded a lot of change in terms of the political landscape. South Africa, we saw an end to apartheid, and the long-drawn civil war in Mozambique also came to an end. And for us here in Malawi, we also saw an end to the dictatorial rule of Dr. Banda. And so that impacted a lot on the media landscape here in Malawi. Actually, you will recall that in 1993, 94, 92, 93, 94, there was a proliferation of newspapers that flooded the market. Suddenly, from having just the Times, the Daily Times, and the Malawi News at the time, and another government publication, which was in vernacular, we had a plethora of newspapers on the market, and all of them championing democracy in Malawi, giving people alternative views. And so that's what we had. But unfortunately, most of those newspapers did not live long because these were journalists who were passionate about their work, who were enthusiastic to finally be free and to tell the stories of the people, tell the horrors that Malawians experienced under the one-party rule, that they did not really have the business acumen. And so most of the newspapers closed. And to date, in Malawi, we only have two thriving newspapers. In the case of South Africa, I think that we continue to look up to the rest of the region, continues to look up to the media in South Africa because of its independent nature in general, and also because of the much as we're all, the media across the region and across the world is struggling, but there's a level of financial independence that colleagues in South Africa continue to enjoy. As Mr. Malawi as well, we track progress in terms of independence in the different countries. I would say that the situation in Mozambique is slightly concerning. There was the case of a journalist who was murdered just outside his house in last year, but we haven't. We heard that the one who assassinated him was arrested, but we have not had much progress on that. So yeah, basically, the region, we tend to learn from each other, but South Africa, being the regional power, being also the region's major economy, continues to shine the light in terms of media freedom.
As you were talking, there's something I just wanted to expand on, which you were talking about how, in this case of Malawi's context, at the beginning of the emergence of a multi-party democracy in 94, there were all these proliferation of many papers. So one of the major problems you see in Malawi in particular, but other countries as well, is the financial capital to support journalism. So that's a big concern in terms of how journalists survive, right?
This one is a really big problem. We do know that the rest of the world is also struggling, obviously due to the rise in social media platforms, due to the rise in the new media championed by Google and platforms such as Facebook, now X, and the like. But in the African context, the problem, one of the major problems has been that the government is one of the biggest advertisers. And as we know, the business model all along has been that we generate content that attracts eyeballs, and these eyeballs in turn attract advertisers. So now, for most African countries, including Malawi, the government is the biggest advertiser. So if you're not in good books with the government, the chances are that you will be denied of advertising. And so I think our expansion into other models, into how else we can make money, has not really borne much fruit. But also depends on the economy of that particular country. For instance, the Malawi economy is one that is generally struggling. So in the face of the rise of these platforms, we have seen that companies advertise directly and are able to meet their audiences or their customers on their own stages. They have massive push. Why would they want to advertise in mainstream media? But there's also growing issues, not just here in Malawi, here in Africa, but also across the continent, across the world, of the media. And so people nowadays would rather trust an individual, let's say you, Musa, and you're an influential person, they'll trust you. You yourself become the content creator, and you yourself become the platform. So they develop their trust in you, and you know, that's the sort of environment that the media today is grappling with. And indeed, because of the size of our economy, for instance, we only have two newspapers. The rest, no matter how much they try to come onto the market, they do not survive. We have a few thriving broadcasters. The rest are really struggling. And we find that the struggle of the industry places a lot of pressure in terms of the kind of journalism that we're able to churn out.
And when you were talking, something that's kind of sparked my curiosity is also the rise of the social media, and also how is that playing a role with citizen journalism, as they say? Because you have as you mentioned, the two papers in Malawi, which are the Nation and of course the Daily Times. And the Nation comes, actually, last year was the 30th anniversary. So it's a new paper, very, very, I mean, in the context of Malawi's history.
Yeah, quite new. Yes.
Quite new.
Because the Times started in 1895.
Yeah. So, and then you have, this new emerging citizen journalism on the social media, but also, community radio. How is the establishment media see those two emerging fields? Do they see it as a threat, or do they see it as complementing what they have to do?
I think that the rise in social media has enabled people to tell their own stories from wherever they are in the country. Most of our major media outlets are concentrated in the cities. So unlike in the US, where you're broadcasting from, where you see a lot of community sort of media, where people don't necessarily rely on national media. So you will find that a lot of information and stories happening in the district, in the rural areas, was not making it onto the main media platforms because they did not have a presence in those areas. So you'll find that the social media influencers and others, the ones that we're calling citizen journalists, I'm not sure I should call journalists because of the way they do their work, are filling in that gap of the absence of the major media outlets in the districts or in the rural areas. The trouble, though, is that the information that they share normally has not been verified, has not been balanced, and sometimes the ethic is thrown to the dog. The ethics are thrown to the dogs. You will find an accident scene, bloody accident scene, dead bodies being posted online without much regard to the emotions and the feelings of the relatives of these people. So we could say, of the affected people. So we could say that, yes, they're playing a complementary role, but they're also giving rise to a lot of misinformation and disinformation, because people begin to trust some of these content creators, and without who in some cases, actually in most cases, post information that has not been verified. On the other hand, they have also helped the mainstream media, because sometimes they'll break stories, sometimes they'll have, we call them zigoba. These are like masks. You know, the traditional, the African mask, where you mask yourself, but underneath you are something else. So it has given rise to those masked people who sometimes leak information that has helped journalists to go and investigate some of the leaked information that they bring out, except that they don't go further to balance, dig out the information. But to an extent, they have helped. But the fear is that politicians begin also to use these social media influencers or citizen journalists to peddle sometimes their agenda, to peddle misinformation, and going into elections that will prove to be quite tricky.
You've just been listening to a portion of a recent conversation with Chisoma Ngulue, who is the vice chairperson of Media Institute of Southern Africa, Malawi, MISA Malawi. And Chisoma Ngulue was talking to us from Lilongwe, and she has over 20 years experience in various media capacities and is a 2017 Harvard University Nieman Journalism Fellow. Currently, she's head of broadcasting at the Malawi Parliament. Earlier, the show featured a conversation with Abdurahim Fukura, and he was talking to us from Washington, D.C. He is the Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera, who has over 30 years' experience in journalism in various positions at the BBC and Al Jazeera. These recent conversations were presented as we commemorate the World Press Freedom Day, which is May 3rd. The conversations focused on issues concerning the media, the challenges such as financial constraints, attacks and killings of journalists, political interference, and more, and the responsibilities such as disseminating accurate information, professionalism, and more. And also featured was the constraints that Al Jazeera is facing as it tries to highlight the plight of Palestinians in Gaza and beyond. The full conversations will be available on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Again, that's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Bao Bao Sunset by Manu Dibango. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Moise Mtali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shao Nana with Zain Al-Amin, looking at the situation in Gaza and in the Middle East and Northern African region. And that's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by Human Rights and Justice with Nakichi Taifa, which is followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, and that's followed by Combit La Kai with Eugenia Charles, looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcasts and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope, and thanks to our engineer Michael Nasella, and thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Kozer and Funan Gonda, and our Africa World Now project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdiston. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW, and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. And I just want to remind you that next week we begin our spring pledge drive and look forward to seeing you then. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled My Motherland Africa by Lawi. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe. Lawi.
The sun will rise from the east and set to the west on a beautiful African day. The beauty in the river as the water flows, and I can't do nothing but swim. It's amazing how nature falls in sync. I see the reason why he said it was good. Amazing creation. As the mother and daughter fetch water from the stream, they sing beautiful songs of peace in some ululation. The men gather under sheds of beautiful trees, and peaceful reasoning is all I see.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Police cleared a pro-Palestinian tent encampment at George Washington University early today and arrested at least 33 protesters. A statement from MPD said the department worked closely with GW administration in the clearing. The move on the encampment came just hours before the district's mayor and police chief were set to testify on Capitol Hill before the Republican-led House Oversight Committee about why they had declined requests from the university for nearly 2 weeks to clear the encampment from the school grounds. This comes after six Republican members of the Oversight Committee visited the encampment and called on officials to arrest protesters involved. Today's planned hearing was canceled after police cleared the encampment. In related news, the Israel Defense Forces are continuing ground operations in areas of eastern Rafah, according to a statement today, amid mounting global opposition. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said yesterday the operation would continue and deepen until Israel eliminates Hamas in Rafah and the rest of Gaza, or until the first hostage held by Hamas returns to Israel. This comes after Israel launched a major military offensive in Rafah yesterday, seizing control of a key border crossing and blocking humanitarian aid from entering the territory where more than 1 million civilians are sheltering. Humanitarian groups were already warning of famine in parts of the territory due to aid delivery restrictions. The World Health Organization said today that the closure of the Rafah border crossing meant health services in southern Gaza would run out of fuel in 3 days. In other news, former President Donald Trump's classified documents trial was postponed indefinitely yesterday. The decision by Judge Eileen M. Cannon was expected given the number of legal issues that remain unresolved less than 2 weeks from the date she had originally set. A new trial date has not been set. Trump is charged in the case with mishandling and illegally holding on to classified material after leaving the White House, and with obstructing the government's repeated efforts to retrieve it from him. Trump pleaded not guilty last June to a 37-count indictment, and if he returns to the Oval Office in January, he could appoint an attorney general who is willing to drop the federal charges against him. In addition, Justice Department policy forbids the criminal prosecution of a sitting president. And severe weather and tornadoes have been wreaking havoc across the Plains, Ohio Valley, and Great Lakes regions for multiple days. In the last 2 days, more than 40 tornadoes have now been reported across the span of 11 states. Meanwhile, more tornadoes are probable today and tomorrow, with the highest risk between southern Missouri and middle Tennessee. Yesterday, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer issued the first ever tornado emergency on record for her state. A tornado emergency, which the National Weather Service first started in 1999, is issued only when catastrophic damage is imminent or ongoing, as is the threat to human life. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 86 degrees under fair skies. Temperatures are forecast to remain in the mid to high 80s for the rest of the day. Tomorrow, temperatures are forecast to drop to the mid 60s.